All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And, boy, I feel like I just ran into the studio. The seat of my pants, or actually sitting on the seat of my pants. Of course, that would be natural, but I'm just sitting on the edge of the seat. Our show today is packed at the back end of the show, and it's only two guests, but at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Odessa Osakalumi, who is one of the alternates, one of the two people who plays the role of Fela, and it's the play that tells the life of Fela Anikolapo Kuti, the Nigerian musician, a revolutionary musician who created Afrobeat and whose music inspired millions in its stand against colonialism, oppression, and all kinds of barbarity. That'll be at the back end of the show. But before that, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Worthington. Andy Worthington is a freelance investigative journalist who has dedicated, at least the last 6 years to exposing the truth about Guantanamo and the people held in Guantanamo, the nature of Guantanamo. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. And he's the co-director of the documentary film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And on the 10th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo, Andy is joining us to talk about the past somewhat, but the present and what the hell continues to go on in Guantanamo. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be back talking to you.
Yeah, you too, man. Well, I got so many questions for you, I'm just going to jump into the thing right away, all right?
Okay.
Amnesty International, on this 10th anniversary of Guantanamo, of the opening of Guantanamo, it struck me reading through your website, you make a point that Amnesty International has called Guantanamo an icon of lawlessness, and you yourself have referred to it as having a toxic legacy. Why?
Yeah. Well, it's because, you know, the whole purpose of setting up Guantanamo when the Bush administration did it was that they were fed up with international laws and treaties that had been developed over a long time. And what they wanted to be able to do was to hold people without any rights at all, really no rights whatsoever. And they essentially were capturing people who, some who were soldiers, some who were terror suspects, as well as, of course, the large numbers of completely innocent people, sending them all out to Cuba and declaring that they were illegal enemy combatants without any rights. And it took 2.5 years for the Supreme Court to say, actually, you know, we've got guys in Guantanamo saying that they didn't do anything and you caught them by mistake. And you set something up where if somebody says they're innocent and were caught by mistake, there is absolutely nothing they can do about it. That's really a totally unacceptable way for a civilized country to behave. So that's what it was. We've had legal struggles over the years to at least nominally create some rights for the people who are held there. For various reasons, we've reached a position where no one can leave now. Of the remaining 171 men, they're all still held there with no sign of when, if ever, any of them are going to leave. But the issue of who they are and how they're defined and the extra legal establishment of Guantanamo in the first place is essentially the same. These men held there, some soldiers, some terror suspects, some still innocent people mistakenly regarded as a threat to the United States, are all still not a recognizable form of prisoner. They're held outside of the mainstream, outside of the norms. They're not called illegal enemy combatants anymore, but the Obama administration hasn't really done away with at all what I've called the toxic legacy inherited from the Bush administration. And that's what needs to go, Michael. We need to get back to a position where we say terror suspects are people involved in criminal activity. We have ways of dealing with that. And soldiers are soldiers. And we all agreed over a long time that we had the Geneva Conventions as a way of dealing appropriately and humanely with people captured in wartime.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Geneva Conventions seem to have disappeared in the dust somewhere. Somebody threw them out, I think, somewhere a long time ago.
Yeah, I think that's very much a casualty of the Bush administration's response to 9/11. And, you know, it's something that the Obama administration hasn't reinstituted. I mean, you know, Obama could have come in and said, we are, you know, absolutely committing ourselves once more to the way in which the Geneva Conventions work. But if you look at the detentions in Bagram in Afghanistan, for example, where there's a kind of weird setup where they round people up and hold them for quite a long time before giving them a hearing, which is derived from the kind of hearings they invented for Guantanamo. What's that got to do with the Geneva Conventions? They went AWOL 10 years ago and they haven't been returned.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Obama has been very busy, though. You have to give him this. He's been very busy figuring out just who is he going to execute extrajudicially. You know, that's
right, exactly.
Yeah. So we're on the same track there. Okay. Now, Andy, one of the things that you've talked about, and this really struck me too, is that you make a very strong argument. You say, look, much – and frankly, this is what a lot of the world thinks. They think that much of what has been done in Guantanamo, even its existence, at least there was an attempt to justify it by the idea that these are the worst of the worst and it's what's necessary if you want to keep the world free of terrorism. Of course, they don't say anything about terrorism practiced by the major imperialist powers, but we'll leave that to the side for the moment.
Yeah.
But you argue that today in Guantanamo – and I think you would argue for to a large extent for throughout its existence – that the people, the prisoners there, and especially the ones that are there today, are political prisoners, which is something that is not that widely argued. Why do you argue that?
Well, I think it's been a consequence of the lawlessness of the place in the first place, was that, having established somewhere that was committed to the interrogation of prisoners, whether coercive or not, and not with the established rules about the detention of prisoners. The Bush administration was always in a position where it didn't really know what it was going to do with people. It's been difficult to work out how people were going to be released and on what basis they were going to be released. And the Bush administration set up a process whereby there were constant reviews of prisoner status to work out whether they were regarded as dangerous still, to work out whether they were regarded as having intelligence value. But what really happened was that people were released only partly through these internal reviews processes, and a large part of it was political. A large part of it was Western countries, for example, saying, we want our nationals back. And as we saw in 2004 and 2005, most of the Europeans left. Other countries, there were deals. So initially, the US and Saudi, for example, the relationship between those two countries was very cold. Most of the hijackers on 9/11 came from Saudi Arabia, and yet Saudi Arabia is a very staunch ally of the United States in terms of the money-making business and the oil. So, it took years for a deal to be hammered out there, but a deal was made in the end whereby the Saudis set up a rehabilitation program, and most of the Saudis in Guantanamo went home. Well, other people were not so fortunate, and the Yemenis, who make up over half of the remaining prisoners, are the ones who have been the brunt of the failure to resolve any of the issues around Guantanamo adequately. Because diplomatically, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration have had difficulty believing that it can trust Yemen to keep an eye on people that it releases. I mean, we could certainly argue that you have no right to be demanding looking at people after they've been released, which is a kind of other issue. But Yemen's borne the brunt of it. And politically, we've just hit a brick wall with the release of any of the Yemenis, primarily because of hysteria about the failed Christmas Day bomber in 2009, a man called Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who was captured coming into Detroit with a bomb in his underwear which failed to blow up. Disaster was averted, but people behaved as though it wasn't. And the fact that he was recruited in Yemen is something that played heavily on lawmakers' fears. And they then demanded of the president that he not release anyone back to Yemen. And the president capitulated, as he frequently has capitulated. Now, the terrible thing about this is that he had just received the results of a year-long review by career officials in various government departments and intelligence agencies, reviewing the cases of all the prisoners. And they have said that, the 28 Yemenis can go home straight away and that another 30 can go home if the security situation improves. Suddenly Obama is, responding to this hysteria, saying, okay, we're not releasing any, I'm issuing a moratorium. That was 2 years ago. We've no sign anywhere of any suggestion from the establishment that, maybe it's time to start releasing some of these people who were cleared for release back to Yemen. So they're stuck there. And I think that it's appropriate to describe these people as political prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's appropriate to describe other people who have been failed by all of the legal processes. Other cleared prisoners who can't safely be returned to their home countries, but no other country has been found. America has refused to take any responsibility for these people.
Well, let me ask you this, Andy. First, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's a freelance investigative journalist, the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, and he runs a hell of a website. If you want to know anything at all about the savage barbarity of Guantanamo and what it stands for and what it is, go to his website. It's a fantastic website. Now, Andy, you were just talking about this thing about these are our political prisoners. I couldn't agree with you more. I also think there's something that comes up when you start to talk about the people who remain in the prison. And you've also said that the Obama administration, Congress, and the judiciary have all made sure that Guantanamo may never close and few, if any, of the remaining prisoners will be released. Let's talk about this, because you have the 89 who have already been approved for release, which seems to just to be a total blockade of whether or not they're going to be released, and for some pretty outrageous conditions on that. And then we have the others. Yeah. Let's walk through this, the ones who've been approved, the ones who are waiting to face trial or charges, and then the ones who've been designated as prisoners to be held indefinitely without charge or trial.
Sure. Yeah, well, okay, so you've got the 89, as you say, who were cleared for release by the Obama administration's Guantanamo Review Task Force. I mean, I think it's important to stress, you know, this is a pretty sober collection of career officials and lawyers, representatives from the intelligence agencies. They're not making decisions lightly about who to release or not. So, you know, it remains the greatest of shames on this 10th anniversary, but the U.S. government does not want to hold indefinitely 89 of these 171 guys still held, and yet they're all still stuck there. And, you know, the biggest responsibility for that rests with Congress, because Congress has passed provisions in legislation over the last couple of years imposing ridiculous demands, actually, on the administration about releasing prisoners. So as it stands, the Defense Secretary has to promise to Congress that if anyone is released, there's absolutely no way that they would be able to engage in any kind of activities against the interests of the United States. It's a guarantee that you can't actually make. So they've just been cutting off any route whereby people can leave. They also, one of the recent things that they did was to say, if there's a single incident of somebody released from Guantanamo from a particular country having engaged allegedly in activities against the United States, then, you know, then it is prohibited for any prisoner to be released to that country. Let's look at the domestic prison system and say somebody released from the U.S. domestic prison system from Colorado goes back home and commits a crime. Would it be acceptable to say, in light of this, we declare that no prisoner from Colorado can ever be released from the domestic prison system again? That's what's happening. That's the extent of the hysteria surrounding Guantanamo. So Congress bears a huge blame for that, but it is also the president's responsibility. You know, he had the option early on. His senior lawyer, White House counsel Greg Craig, came up with a plan to bring some of the Uyghurs, these Chinese guys who completely seized by mistake, to live in the United States. It would have helped other countries to be involved in rehousing people, and it would have sent a great message to the world, and it would have punctured this persistent propaganda about the dangerousness of the prisoners. But when he got criticized, the Republicans picked up on this and were about to cause trouble about it, he backed down. That was a huge failure. And his failure to stand up for the right of Yemenis not to be all regarded as terrorists and to impose this moratorium after the underpants bomber was apprehended, that was another great failure. There has been a persistent lack of courage when pushed by the administration, which has helped to compound this problem. The other issue with the judiciary, Michael, involves the prisoners' habeas corpus petitions, which there was a big tug of war between the Supreme Court and Congress under President Bush. Supreme Court gave the prisoners habeas corpus rights. They were taken away by Congress. They were reinstated by the Supreme Court in 2008. And after that, several dozen prisoners won victories. They had judges look at the evidence against them and say, this isn't evidence. You have no reason to hold these guys. Some of them were released as a result of this. And then right-wing judges in the D.C. Circuit Court, the appeals court in Washington, D.C., got hold of it. And really, for nakedly ideological reasons, they're rewriting the detention rules. They're saying to the lower courts, you're lending far too much credibility to the prisoner's stories here. You're over-interrogating the government's own information. The last terrible ruling that they made, which I hope will go to the Supreme Court, told the judges to regard everything, pretty much everything that the government says is evidence, to regard that as reliable. And what we're talking about here are intelligence reports made in the field on capture. We're talking about this terrible, terrible legacy of statements made by the prisoners themselves or by their fellow prisoners that are unreliable, and they're proven to be unreliable in so many cases because people were coerced or tortured, or in some cases because they were offered better living conditions if they ratted on their fellow prisoners. I don't mean that to sound like a judgment. If I'd been put in Guantanamo, who knows, you know, if any of us think about what would happen if we were put under that pressure. But, you know, this is the discredited evidence And yet the circuit court has, without exaggeration, what the judges there have done is to destroy habeas corpus as a remedy for prisoners held in Guantanamo. So, you know, this nearly 800-year-old tradition of having judges impartially review the evidence to determine whether the king initially or now the government has the right to hold someone has been gutted of its meaning by a handful of right-wing judges in Washington, D.C., which is disgraceful and also underreported.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Andy Worthington. Andy's a freelance investigative journalist who spent a good part of his life over the last six or more years investigating what's going on with Guantanamo and bringing the truth out to people all over the world. Check out his website. It's really incredible.
Michael, shall we go and shall I just talk briefly now about the people put forward for trials and the ones held indefinitely?
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah, so there are, you know, there are 171 guys in Guantanamo, 89 cleared for release, still stuck there. When the task force reviewed the prisoners' cases, they recommended 36 of the remaining prisoners to be put forward for trials, and they recommended 48 to be held indefinitely without charge or trial. But that's now 46 because two of them died in Guantanamo last year. So the people facing trials, well, we haven't had many. We've had a few trials by military commission at Guantanamo, mostly being settled through plea deals. We had a terrible ruling just over a year ago in the case of Omar Khadr, the Canadian former child prisoner, who was made to agree to a plea deal whereby he explained that it was a war crime for a child to be in a combat situation with U.S. forces under any circumstances. It's essentially making a war crime out of war when you're opposing the U.S. forces, and they did this to a child. That really will stand as one of the most disgraceful things that Barack Obama did or let happen. But, you know, the military commissions have a very checkered and very dubious history ever since they were kind of dragged back out of retirement by Dick Cheney in 2001. For various reasons, the possibility of having federal court trials for any of these people accused of terrorism have been cut off. And we've seen interference on that basis, particularly by Congress. And most lately, we've seen an element of that come back in terms of Congress passing these provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act, whereby they want terror suspects to be held in military custody without charge or trial, something that they've inherited very directly from what George W. Bush initiated at Guantanamo. And for this to be happening 10 years after the 9/11 attacks, after the death of bin Laden, reflects very badly, I think, on the sanity and sense of proportion that lawmakers have. But, you know, these are the guys put forward for trial. We can all probably say that if there's a case against people, then they really should be put on trial. And then we can argue about whether the venue is appropriate. Mm-hmm. The 46 who are recommended for indefinite detention without charge or trial, that's a very troubling position for these men to be in. And for President Obama to have authorized, because this is exactly what the Bush administration did, was to hold people indefinitely without charge or trial. And the rationale for it is really rather disgraceful as well, because the administration has decided that these people are too dangerous to release, but there isn't anything that can be used as evidence against them. Now, if you or I were to stand back and objectively look at that, it means that you don't actually have the evidence. What you've got is hearsay. What you've got is variations on those unreliable statements made by the prisoners that I was mentioning before. So, you know, that's the situation with Guantanamo now, with nobody leaving and with these categories of prisoners in which there are great problems with all of them.
Now, Andy, we have about 5 minutes, and I want to get this question in because I think it's extremely important. It's a recent development. And as I'm listening to you, in effect, there's actually what's been enshrined as official policy, whether they say this or not, and in fact, they are saying it more and more these days, is that indefinite detention without trial is part of official policy now. Now, let's talk about the National Defense Authorization Act, which has a lot to do with that. And you point out that while little has been said about it, there is people have talked a lot about the mandatory military custody of terrorist suspects. But the point you make is that there's been a very little said about the specific sections of this act regarding Guantanamo and that they, in fact, are designed to prevent the closure of Guantanamo.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is very much tied in with that. And you know, people have been very concerned about the military custody obligations that are included in the Act. And there are waivers in that which indicate that, it certainly suggests that the president was unhappy. And as you mentioned before, Michael, the president is happy to dispose of U.S. citizens that he doesn't like by assassinating them in drone attacks, not imprisoning them indefinitely without charge or trial. So, you know, people have got quite worked up about the idea that this applies to U.S. citizens. And I think, you know, I think it's always been important to recognize that the treatment of foreigners is something that could indicate the kind of threats that U.S. citizens might face, that it's not enough to dismiss these people as foreigners and accept that whatever happens to them is inappropriate, because it really isn't. But very little attention has been paid to these other provisions in the NDAA, making it almost impossible for the president to release anyone from Guantanamo because of these obligations. And this problem that we've had all this time with what Congress has been doing. And, of course, this is not new in this act. It's been there before. And so I hope that people do realize what's been going on, because Congress was first passing some of these provisions well over a year ago, and yet it's been largely ignored. It's been largely ignored that Congress has imposed these. Jay Johnson, Pentagon's senior lawyer, described them as onerous and almost impossible to fulfill, or something along those lines recently. And, you know, we need to have people understand that Guantanamo needs to be closed, because it isn't going to close otherwise. We can see that all the branches of government have failed. It needs to come from the people, a strong message of saying this is intolerable. And, you know, hopefully that's what we're going to have some impetus towards that as a result of this being the 10th anniversary.
Well, I want to say that you're in the country now. You're going to be traveling around the country, making speaking engagements, talking about what's going on in Guantanamo, why it's important to know the truth about it, and the need for people to stand up and demand that it be shut, that this is a crime against humanity. Maintaining Guantanamo is in fact itself a war crime, I think so. Andy, give people your website real quick.
Yeah, sure. It's www.andyworthington.co.uk.
Okay, so .co, just so people, you know, you have to do this in this country. You have to say .co.uk, because people,
right.
You know, they might look at co, C-O-E. I don't know what the hell's going on here. Anyway, Andy, thank you very much for your work and for joining us on the show today. And I look forward to having you back again soon. Maybe the next time we'll be talking about something dramatic, about like the closing of Guantanamo. Let's hope
Wouldn't that be nice to think, Michael?
It would be great. Great. All right, Andy.
In the meantime, it's been a great pleasure. Thank
you. You too, man. Thank you. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And that was Andy Worthington. He's an independent investigative journalist who spent a large part of his career over the last 6 years investigating the truth about Guantanamo and bringing it out for people to know so that they can act. Really pay attention to what's going on around Guantanamo. It is important for people to stand up and know the truth and demand that it be shut down. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you'll be listening to an interview I did with Adesola Osakalumi, who is one of the two actors who plays Fela Kuti in the play Fela, which has just come off Broadway and is now touring the country. So we're going to be talking with Adesola about the play, about Fela, and we're going to go into that right after this break. But just a few words for people who don't know who Fela was. Fela was a revolutionary musician who dedicated his life to standing up against injustice and savage barbarity, imperialism, colonialism, and making music that would keep people's butts moving and their heads snapping, and inspired millions. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, that's what you'll be listening to.
International team. International team. International team.
All right, you've just been listening to International Thief Thief from Fela Kuti, and, or as Fela would put it, International Thief Thief. It's a song which really captures the ethos and the spirit
of a new play. Well, a play that's new to most of the country, but was on Broadway for quite some time. I think it stayed there until every person of conscience, every conscious person,
got a chance to see it. And then it went on tour around the country. It's currently on tour around the country. And the play is just a remarkable play. It's one of the, I see a lot of plays, and people know I talk with a lot of people about the plays I see. But this is really has to be one of the top five plays that I've ever seen. It was just an incredible, incredible musical theater that was just beyond anything I could have possibly imagined. And here to talk with us about the play is Adesola Osakalumi. Adesola is one of the alternates that plays the lead character in the play, Fela Anakulapo Kuti. And he's a musician who had the audacity to declare music is a weapon and then went on to show what he meant by producing music that not only had you shaking your butt, but also had your mind snapping and understanding the world and really thinking about things in a whole different way. Adesola, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here, Michael. It's good to be here in warm, sunny Los Angeles.
All right. Well, it's good to have you here, man. So that's the size of it. Well, you know, there's a with this play, and I have to say, when I went there, it was just such an air of excitement. Even on New Year's Eve, seeing it, you know, where people were coming in and they were just like, there was an air of excitement about it on one level, and then it was also at the intermission, it became one thing that really struck me was that a lot of people came to the play based on its reputation, but didn't know too much about the content of the play. They didn't know too much about Fela, and, you know, people hadn't really heard of, you know, a number of people, not everybody. There were a number of people who had heard of, quite a few Nigerians were there. People from West Africa were there, other people, musicians, all kinds of people were there who had heard of Fela Kuti. But there were also a number of people who hadn't heard of it and whose minds were blown when they saw the play. So why don't we tell people a little of what the play is, what they can expect if they went to see it?
Well, Fela tells the story of Fela Anakulapo Kuti, who was a Nigerian musician, political activist, incredible composer, and a person who lived his life with the belief that not only was music a weapon and music should be used to be a weapon, but that music and the arts would be used to liberate and free people from injustice. He was a freedom fighter. He fought against tyranny from the Nigerian government, from multinational corporations. And I think what people will get when they see the show, aside from the pageantry, the incredible choreography, his fantastic compositions, they will see his message that is still prevalent and resonating in the world with what's going on today about injustice, about people standing up and fighting for their rights. And he was a person who was very close to his family, came from a very prominent family, and believed that people should do what was right, and he took the stance that he would dedicate his life to exposing corruption wherever it was in the world. It's a really powerful play, wrapped around incredible choreography, music, and pageantry.
Well, this is one of the things that really hits you when you see the play, is that, you know, it doesn't rely on so much sort of telling you the story in a sort of narrative fashion as it does. It mobilizes all of what Fela was, his personality, his music, as you're saying, the choreography, the set, which is incredible, you know, the costumes, everything, which is it seems to be totally mobilized to actually tell the story in a way that sort of brings you in and then rolls it out, you know? And I thought that was an incredibly interesting way to do this.
You know, one thing, there are quite a few things that are different about our show. Bill T. Jones, who directed and choreographed it, was very conscious of immersing the crowd from the first time they walk in. So the band is playing. It's a very participatory experience as opposed to most theatrical productions where you come in and you sit and you watch. We implore and cajole and exhort the audience to get up, to talk back to us on stage, to really be a part of the shrine. The conceit, the play is set in Fela's last performance at his nightclub, The Shrine, before he's going to leave Nigeria and go to the West to live a different and better life. And throughout the course of the play, through retelling his life story, interactions with his mother, who passed away in the play, and his one of his many girlfriends, but very important girlfriend and social
kind of an educator named Sandra Isidore, he decides to not leave. So the play really pulls people in. We break the fourth wall repeatedly throughout the evening. And I think what people really walk away with, whether they have a background on Fela's history and music or not, they walk away and see this is not just a musical that is a feel-good musical, although it is. It's a musical with a very direct, clear conscience and telling a very clear story about injustice and the human condition.
Yeah, actually, one reviewer I read actually said it was a soundtrack for uprisings.
Ah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, very good.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Now let's talk about this breaking down the fourth wall, because that was very interesting to me. It was sort of you became, you know, there wasn't even from the very beginning, there wasn't even really the element of sort of you were in a theater watching a play about a performance. You actually became, it was a performance that was about, that included, that embraced it. You actually felt like you were in the shrine.
Absolutely.
And you had the job of actually speaking to people and really pulling people into that. How was that for you? Because it's one thing to occasionally break down the fourth wall, but it's another thing to have the whole play do away with the fourth wall almost completely.
that's true. I think it's a great challenge and a great responsibility to get people involved because, you know, traditionally people are not accustomed to speaking back or being part of a theatrical presentation. So, you know, when we enter the house, we enter from the back of the house. So right from there, we're walking through the people. We're looking at the people. The area boys who are my escorts and protectors and guides are talking to the people from before we get on stage. I think that kind of sets the tone. I think what we our approach, and I think we're very successful in letting people realize, leave all expectations outside. You know, Sa, the other Fela, always says, leave your shy outside when you come to this show. It is time to leave all inhibitions at home, wherever you are. You know, I always say, are you people asleep? Did you come to sleep or you came to party? You know, did you come to sleep? Because if you came to sleep in the wrong place, it feels really good. And by the time the second act begins, I come back out and I pose another question to the audience, another kind of call and response. And the audience at that point is so open and is much more aware and much more involved in the proceedings. So there's a progression that we can feel on stage from the beginning of the show, when the audience is like, you know, I don't know if I should speak, you know, this is a little uncomfortable, to, of course, I want to speak, yes, and we like that, and they want to get up and dance in the aisles. There have been shows when people have literally jumped up and tried to run on stage and dance.
Yeah.
So I think that is one of the many things about the show that helps and reaches people on a very visceral, emotional level.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Adesola Osakalumi, and he is one of the actors, one of the artists that plays the character Fela Anakalapo Kuti in the play Fela. Now, Ade, an interesting thing. I mean, you had me sold, as I asked you when we performed this interview, when we started this interview. You know, I was asking you, well, which country were you from? And, you know, because you had me convinced, you became so much Fela. You know, which to me was very, very heavy for an actor to do, especially in any scene, in any play, it's hard, in any role, it's hard to really become that person to such an extent as I think you did. And then, but at the same time, you're actually doing a character that, you know, I mean, there was so much involved. He was such a complex
yes.
human being. There was so
yes.
much involved in that. What was it like actually getting to that point where you could become him?
Well, playing Fela is an ongoing process. I am still investigating. I'm still pulling back layers, and it's the type of role that any actor would die for, would kill for, would live for. You are really, you know, I'm on stage just about the whole show. I sing, I dance, I move around, and it just took a lot of research. Fela's family has been very supportive and very much involved in coming to the show, talking with us, both Femi, his son Femi, and Shayun, and his daughter Yeni. They've been, you know, really open, and I take it as a great responsibility to play someone who was a real person whose legacy still resonates. And it's a trip. I call it sinking in. You know, I have done a lot of research and continue to do research. And there's just that moment when the show starts and you have that blue suit on and those suits. And when you saw the show, so you know the suits, right? It's mm-hmm. his attire. And I just release. We let go and allow the energy of Fela, which we all feel on that stage, to resonate. And I feel that guides me, in addition to the preparation that I've done, the physical level of preparation, the vocal preparation, the preparation on the dialect, just things that, you know, it's part of the job. So mm-hmm. that's what it calls for. But it's a great responsibility. And I'm very, very, very honored and humbled to be fortunate enough to play the role and to be a part of this experience. It's sometimes really hard to describe.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're a relatively young man, and how much did you know much about Fela?
I actually did know a lot about Fela. I was very fortunate, and in another great irony, my family owned a record label called Makosa Records. And Makosa Records was the first record company that distributed Fela's music in the West back in the 70s. So my uncles and father knew Fela, had some business dealings, relations with Fela, obviously as his distributor, met Fela many times. I met him in passing very, very briefly, two times. So I did know about his music. I knew about him. I knew about his life. And now to be part of the production and to eventually and to start playing Fela is a great thing. But I tell you, knowing about him is one thing. But, you know, again, getting into the character, doing the work, and working with Bill T. Jones and his approach and his direction and certain elements that came through his prism, you know, it's a kind of another level. But mm-hmm. I did have a lot of background information on Fela, yes.
Ah, cool. You know, it's interesting when you mentioned Bill T. Jones, and he is, I mean, he is remarkable in most of the stuff that he does. But this thing, I think, this piece really took things just to a whole other level in my mind. And one of the things I'd ask you is, was there something, you know, one of the things that surprised me is when I found out that actually the book for the play was actually, was drawn a lot from the lyrics and the music and the dance itself, you know. Mm-hmm. And what was it, was there anything in the play that really surprised you?
No, I don't think anything in the play particularly surprised me. I think they were very true to his life. And, you know, the time constraints of a Broadway or theatrical production are, you know, two and three quarter hours tops. This play, when it ran off Broadway and in various workshops, from what I was told, was almost 4 hours. It was a lot longer. Fela's story could be a miniseries. They need to make a movie about it. It was just so chock full of juicy, full details. So I felt with the time that we have to present a play, the information was very true. Nothing surprised me. I did really like the approach to his mother. You know, Fela's mother, Fumilayo Anikulapo Kuti, was a very instrumental part of his life and shaped his, not just his political agenda, but his agenda, and she supported him in his fight, in his struggle. She herself was a freedom fighter. She was one of what you could say was one of the first female, you know, women's rights advocates, you could say. So I thought that element of his life was addressed very well in the production. But nothing really surprised me. There were a few songs that, you know, many people always like, well, why isn't this song in this show? Why isn't this song? We always say, well, I mean, you know, Fela's music, the shortest things he did might have been 12 or 15 minutes. So, you know, there's only so much you could put in the production. But like you said, in terms of a lot of the music, a lot of the story being told through his lyrics, Fela wrote music that was so visual mm-hmm. and so much a vehicle for storytelling, which is why I think it works so well on stage. Mm-hmm. You know, we're telling a story through this man's music, through his life experiences. And I think it is the work that Bill and the creative team and the lighting and the dressing and all of us on stage as well. You know, I think we have something that we're very proud of. Mm-hmm. And we present it that way every night, 8 times a week. And it's not easy. As Fela would say, it's no easy, yo.
Okay, boy. All right. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking now with Adesola Osakalumi, who plays Fela. He's one of the actors who plays Fela in the play of the same name. And this play has just embarked on a national tour, so keep your eyes and ears peeled in your area. And if it comes there or comes anywhere within reasonable distance, make sure you do everything you can to see it. You won't regret it. Now, Ade, one of the things, you know, it's interesting because when you said that about Fela's music, I mean, it really is true. You know, if you were going to look for, I was thinking, even when I was looking through the songs that were going to be played in there before I saw the play, and I was thinking, wow, you know, there's this, you think about all the influence that Fela had on people all over the world. You know, there was the Red Hot and Riot series that actually dedicated a whole CD to him. There was Black Man's Cry, which showed how music around the world was influenced by him. And there were things like Roy Ayers going and doing a couple of albums with him, Ginger Baker. I mean, amazing stuff. So, you know, to me, that was one of the things I thought was really important, that people got a sense of Fela was a person, he was an artist who cared deeply about Nigeria, but also about the world. And that really that really struck me. And that political acuity that he has really, I thought, caught on and inspired people around the world, which is one of the things I thought the play really, it's really great that it brings that home in the way that it does.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, there's that part in the play when we talk about Fela says he basically wants to leave Nigeria. He wants to go someplace where his family can be more safe. And, you know, why should he stay there? This country and life there is becoming very difficult for him. And his mother comes in, and this is one of the many focal, clear shifts in the play. His mother basically says, you know, you have work to do here. You have work to do here. You have work to do for your people. And this is one of the things that many people don't, I think, fully comprehend about Fela. He would have had more than likely a much more successful financial life had he left Nigeria. He would have signed, a very big recording deal, whether in Europe or in America, and wouldn't have had to endure the harassment, the beatings, the constant confrontation with the armed forces in Nigeria. And he threw all that away. He decided to stay a man of the people, for the people, of the people. He didn't even leave, you know, where his compound was, Kalakuta, which was burned down, not once but twice. He stayed right there in the same area, what one would call, you know, in an urban area. He stayed in the hood. He didn't go to the suburbs of Nigeria. And he really sacrificed. Mm-hmm. He really, really sacrificed for his people. And I think that's why, you know, his music not only resonated when he was alive, but still resonates now. He was much more known and popular in many European countries outside of Nigeria, sometimes than he was in Africa. Mm-hmm. So he paid a price, yes, but what he talked about, you can look at the whole Occupy movement that's been going on for the last year or so, and just what's happening financially with corporations and people saying, this is enough. What do the people need to live and the people need to survive? Fela was singing about this 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I was thinking actually, because when I said that in the beginning of this, that the idea that it gets your butt moving and also your brain snapping, it's really was something. And I was thinking about this when there's a part where Fela says, he's talking about the attitude towards colonialism, and he's talking about the problem around colonialism, and he says, that was a big part of his thing, was really going up against colonialism and the culture of subservience that it put on people from shuffering and smiling and other things. And then he had this thing that, and I don't know whether this came from Fela himself or it was something that was written as part of the book, or the other thing I was going to ask you is how much you guys are actually able to ad lib when you're up there, go on spontaneity, but it's, there's a point where Fela says, at first, talking about colonialism, he says, at first, it's quite nice having new faces around, but then you start noticing things going missing, ashtrays, towels, petroleum, diamonds, people. Yes. And what do they leave in return? Gonorrhea and Jesus.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, that is a line that I like because I think it's funny. I think it's a good little twist with the, at first, it's quite nice. And he kind of gets you with his twist. Some people get offended by that line, in particular because he mentions Jesus. And I don't think Fela was necessarily making a comment about any particular religion at that point in the show. I think what he's talking about is people using religion as a bludgeon, you know, using the theory that what his Nigerian people, what the traditional African people believed in and used was not vital and should have been discarded. He was definitely a person who felt we have been supported by our traditions for all these years and we should maintain them. In terms of the ad-lib, there are a few points in the show where we can really ad-lib, and one of the main ones is in the expensive SHT section. when he likes to spliff, sometimes people, you know, comment about the spliff or ask for some or just make comments. And at that point, we have total license, and both Sa and I, you know, I know I relish that part of the show in particular because, again, it's another moment to connect with the crowd, to show Fela's, you know, sarcastic, playful, you know, needling side. And again, this part of the show, it's a humorous part, but he's talking about being arrested for smoking weed, which he felt as a free African he had the right to do. He's arrested, and they take him to jail and wait for him to use the bathroom to get the evidence to show that he was smoking the weed because he ate it when they came into his house. So all of that is just so rich and so much to work with, you know. But Fela, again, was very clear about the Nigerian government and what he felt were inequities. Mm-hmm. They have a very rich country, and oil is going missing. People are going missing. And where are the funds? The funds are not trickling down to the everyday common man. Mm-hmm. And many people might have felt these things, but he sang about it, and he named names. He was not, covert about his enemies, his agenda. He named names of presidents, military leaders, and that's something that people just don't do still to this day, you know.
Including naming things like AT&T and Halliburton, exactly. And all these places.
He talked about Obasanjo. He talked about all of the Nigerian leaders, mm-hmm, of the day.
Yeah. Now, let me ask. Well, first, let me remind listeners again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Adesola Osakalumi, who's one of the actors playing Fela in the play Fela. Now, Ade, one of the things, we have a couple of questions, a little bit of time left here, but a couple of questions. One is, you know, you look at this and you, so much is centered on the role of Fela, on Fela himself in the play. But at the same time, and it's very interesting because I was talking with my wife about it and she said, you know, it's really true that so much is concentrated on Fela, but at the same time, Fela is very, very much situated. He's very much situated in the midst of everything else that's there. I mean, the set, the space that, yes, you're performing in is just, yes, incredible. You know, that the importance of space, even with the breakdown of the fourth wall, the importance of that space where the audience and you are in that space. And within that space is, you know, an entire universe that was conditioning Fela, and Fela was acting within the context of. And it relies on everybody in the cast, including, this just kick-ass music that's in, yeah, there, that's the band, and the women that are performing as the dancers, and you know, the mother, who's, you know, her voice is just incredible.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Melanie Marshall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Just amazing. And then at the same time, the projections, which also put you in the middle of this very harsh reality at times, that things that might not be able to be projected or from the stage actually are projected onto the stage and into the space and out to the audience. So you have a whole ensemble there that really is an important and, you know, just amazing ensemble that makes the play what it is, I think.
I agree. You know, our show, it's really interesting. People have come to the show and said, oh, I love the show. I got to come see it again because there's so much that they miss. Because there's so much to see, it is almost impossible to come just one time and get everything. Now, that might sound like a shameless plug, and okay, fine, it is, but it's true. You know, it really is true. There are projections going on, as you said, that support visually what Fela and what is talking about. There are projections of some police and government and military issues. The dancing in this show, there has never been dancing like this on Broadway or any touring stage. It just has not been done. We do 8 shows a week. It is African. It is postmodern. It is acrobatic. And the queens and the men really, really, really work so hard. You know, for the majority of the show, people are barefoot. And then when they're not barefoot, the women are in 6-inch heels doing Zombie.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a whole other element. The band Antibalas is one of the, if not the, preeminent Afrobeat band in the world. So it's not traditional so-called house musicians playing, you know, reading the music. These are people who have played Afrobeat for many years before a lot of people thought Afrobeat was cool, and they were out there in the trenches of Afrobeat. So the level of authenticity in terms of what the band delivers also makes it, because, again, when the audience walks in, they hear music from the top before the show starts. The set is a very true-to-life retelling of the Shrine space. Our last show Saturday, a gentleman came up to me after the show and said, you know, I was in Nigeria 25, 35 years ago, and I used to go to the Shrine. And I came in here thinking, oh, this is going to be one of those, you know, really, really watered-down, saccharine type of productions. And he said, you captured the feel of the Shrine, the look of the Shrine. You had it right even down to the woman coming out and lighting Fela's spliff. So a lot of work went into, you know, not just Fela's portrayal and production elements, but the whole show. And I'm really happy that you commented on that. And it's these type of things that keep people coming back to the show. You know, you come to the show, you're watching Fela the first time. Second time, you're going to be watching a lot of what the dancing is. There's so much to see in the show. We've had people who have traveled and followed this show, our show, around. Some people have seen the show 15 and 20 times. So it's really amazing.
You know, Ade, you should not have told me that, because now my wife, I'm going to have to tell her tonight when I get home to call you if I turn up missing. Okay? Maybe following you around the country.
Yes,
an amazing
you have to come
show.
Back.
Yeah.
And then you can follow us.
Okay.
FelaOnBroadway.com also has a lot of our tour information,
right.
Our coming tour information. Yeah.
Right. One last question, and we'll make it quick, but it's one that I can't leave the interview without posing, which is, we don't have to give away a whole lot about the ending, but it's Coughing for the Head of State is the theme, the music that sets the theme for the thing. And in it, it seems to me that scene captures so much about the lasting legacy of Fela Kuti. You know, it's such an amazing piece, including everything from his mother saying, don't let what happened to me be your excuse for giving up, basically.
Right.
And then he emerges with this, and it's done in such an amazing way, the whole trip to the other world and
mm-hmm.
and then emerging, and just the power of that last scene where the question is posed. What's the question that gets posed? Whose coffin will you carry?
Whose coffin are you willing to carry?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's both figurative and literal. You know, and that scene leading up to that scene, I feel it really encompasses all the important elements of what the show is about. You have Fela, a person, you know, on a hero's journey, a hero's quest. You have his relationship with his mother. You have his visit to the land of the Orisha, the traditional, you know, Yoruba religion, Yoruba Orisha gods. You have his feeling on traditional religion, and you have him coming back and saying, not only will I stand here and continue my family's work, but I'm going to pose the question to all of you in the audience, in your lives, how can you go back and make your worlds a better place? What are you willing to sacrifice?
And that's...
what are you willing to give up to make not just your life better, but life for people around you better? And that's the true message of the show, and I think that's what gets people. People leave that show many times crying because it touches something in them. Whether they've been to Nigeria, whether they know about Fela, whether they like Jack, whatever, they feel those human elements that are universal.
Mm-hmm. And that question is still very much the one that's posed before humanity today in every way, and it's
absolutely
really important. We've been talking with Adesola Osakalumi, and Ade, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure was all mine. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Sure, definitely. And I think I will try and make my way down there and see the show again. So
absolutely.
Look for me. I'll be the
big
guy. Yeah, there you go, man. There you go. All right. Thanks a lot, Ade.
Talk to you again soon. You're very welcome. Have a good one.
You
too.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Adesola Osakalumi, who's one of the two actors who plays Fela, the part of Fela in the play of the same name. And the play Fela is currently touring the country, so look for it wherever you live and don't miss it. You know, thinking back on our two guests today, Andy Worthington on the top part of the show talking about Guantanamo and the continued existence of Guantanamo, the war crime that is Guantanamo, and Adesola Sokolumi talking about Fela and Fela's fight to stand up against oppression and to use his music as a weapon to fight against all oppression and all suffering and to bring on a new world. You know, and that's something that we try to bring home each and every week in this show. The fact that we do not have to continue living like this. There's absolutely no reason to live like this except for the existence of this system, this imperialist system. We want a better world, but to get to that better world, it is going to take revolution. And people need to be thinking about that and checking it out. Revolution to bring on a whole new world, a world where we can all work together in common for the common good, where we can all contribute whatever it is that we can contribute, and where we can get back all of the things that we need to live a life worthy of full human dignity. That's right, to live a life worthy of being a human being. I'm Michael Slate. As I said, I'm the host and producer of the show. I want to thank my guests for today, Andy Worthington and Adesola Sokolumi. I want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And most of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more of Fela, and this is Coffin for the Head of State.